News. I'm Tom McNeil. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected international pressure to halt the war in Gaza in a fiery speech marking the country's annual Holocaust Memorial Day. He attacked those accusing Israel of carrying out a genocide against the Palestinians, claiming that Israel is doing everything possible to ensure the entry of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. He added that if Israel must stand alone, it will.
I say to you, we will defeat our genocidal enemies. Never again is now.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's cabinet votes to close Al Jazeera's news channel operations in Israel after rising tensions amid Israel's war with Hamas.
The decision comes following the Israeli government's long-running feud with the Qatari-funded channel. It also comes at a time when ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas are gaining steam. The decision threatens to heighten tensions with Qatar at a time when the Doha government is playing a key role in mediation efforts between the two sides. Al Jazeera has said the closure would affect its operations in East Jerusalem and Israel, but not in the Palestinian territories. I'm Karen Shamas.
Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Sunday that Hamas seemed not to be serious about reaching a truce, saying, "We identified alarming signs that Hamas actually does not intend to go to any agreement with us. This means we will start military actions in Rafah and the entire Gaza Strip in the very near future." Gallant spoke during a visit to central Gaza Strip, where he met Israeli troops and toured the area. Israel has been warning for months it plans to send troops into Rafah, the southern city bordering Egypt, where more than a million displaced Gaza residents have taken refuge. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. As Ukraine marked its third Easter at war, Russia on Sunday launched a barrage of drones concentrated in Ukraine's east, wounding more than a dozen people. Claimed it took troops to control of a village they had been targeting. Ukraine's Air Force said that Russia had launched 24 drones overnight, of which 23 were shot down. Six people, including a child, were wounded in a drone strike in the eastern Kharkiv region, according to the regional governor. 14 more were wounded in an airstrike on Sunday. Some residents of Nairobi suburbs are up in arms over what they say is illegal construction of high-rise buildings in their estates, mainly by Chinese contractors.
In Nairobi's Kilimani suburbs, residents like Cherotich say are pondering their next move to stop what they say is illegal construction in their estate.
And I really call out the Chinese Property Developers Association here. They are complicit. They have understood the propensity and appetite for corruption that you find in this county, and they have exploited it to the hilt.
And as the World Bank projects 70% of the global population will live in cities by 2050, experts say planning will be key for cities like Nairobi. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump accused Democratic rival President Joe Biden over the weekend of running a Gestapo administration. VOA's Joe Ramsey reports from Washington.
Trump made the comparison with the Nazi police in Germany's World War II regime at a donor retreat on Saturday night at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida. He also attacked prosecutors involved in his criminal indictments in a private address to donors, according to a recording heard by U.S. media outlets. Trump's speeches on the campaign trail have drawn criticism from civil rights groups and other critics, with Trump sometimes using violent imagery to go after immigrants and opponents. A White House spokesperson on Sunday accused the former president of echoing fascist rhetoric. Joe Ramsey, VOA News, Washington.
Mexican authorities said Sunday that relatives have positively identified three bodies found in a well as those of two Australian surfers and one American who disappeared last weekend. Baja California state prosecutors said relatives from the two countries had viewed the corpses recovered from a remote well and recognized them as their loved ones. Thieves apparently killed the three who were on a surfing trip to Mexico's Baja Peninsula to steal their truck because they wanted tires. Then they allegedly got rid of the bodies by dumping them in a well near the coast. Three suspects are being held in connection with that case. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
pressure on Israel from the United States and possibly from the International Criminal Court.
The ICC has jurisdiction over four international crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky makes another plea for EU and NATO membership.
Ukraine has fulfilled all the necessary conditions, and now the European Union side must fulfill its obligations.
And Elon Musk makes a surprise visit to China to pitch Tesla.
Tesla is grappling with falling sales and an intensifying price war for EVs led by Chinese brands.
Today is Monday, April 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. The White House says U.S. President Joe Biden has again spoken with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Pressure is building on Israel and Hamas to reach a deal that would free some Israeli hostages and bring a ceasefire into the nearly seven-month-long war in Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is headed back to Israel this week.
That's going to be right at the top of the list for Secretary Blinken to keep pushing for this temporary ceasefire. We want it to last for about 6 weeks. It would allow for all those hostages to get out and, of course, to allow for easier aid access to places in Gaza, particularly up in the north. So he's going to be working on that very, very hard. He'll also be talking to the Israelis about their intentions and their thinking about Rafah military operations and sort of where they are in the planning stages for that.
White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby. The New York Times is reporting that Israeli and foreign officials are saying it appears the International Criminal Court is preparing to issue arrest warrants for senior government officials on charges related to the conflict with Hamas, including Benjamin Netanyahu. Those officials, according to the Times, say they also believe there will be warrants for leaders from Hamas. So what does this mean, if it's true, for the Israeli and Hamas officials? Joining us now to talk about this is Bill Dunlap, a law professor at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut, where he teaches international law, including the law of the sea, counterterrorism, and national security law. So let's start big picture on the International Criminal Court. What jurisdiction do they really have here?
Well, they have jurisdiction primarily over crimes committed by member states or crimes committed in member states. But there are some variations on that, and so it may be possible to prosecute or indict military people or politicians from Israel, even though Israel is not a party to the International Criminal Court.
But the Palestinians are. They let the Palestinians in when the United Nations gave them observer status, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They are members, and therefore it will be easier to justify any indictment against the members of Hamas.
So Israel is not a member of the ICC, and nor, for that matter, is the United States. But so in this instance, let's say this actually happens and they issue arrest warrants for Israeli officials, what happens then? Is it like a situation where you've got Vladimir Putin who can't travel to certain countries because of that hanging over his head?
Yes, the International Criminal Court would be able to issue orders to member states, which are most of the states of the world, ordering them to arrest anyone that the court has indicted. And consequently, it would be extremely risky for Netanyahu or anyone else from either side of the conflict who's been indicted to go traveling around the world.
So let's say that they do go to a country where they can be arrested. Then what happens to them? Are they taken to The Hague?
That's the usual procedure. I'm not sure that has to be exactly what happens, but they are being arrested in a third country because the ICC wants jurisdiction of them, and that's probably what would happen.
Let's say somebody goes, then you've got them, and you now have a trial, I assume, right? Is this like any other trial? You have defense, you have prosecution, you have time to prepare. So sometime in the future after the arrest, there is an actual trial.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And if convicted, what authority does the court have?
The court can issue sentences, and it has issued a number of lifetime sentences to people who've been convicted of very serious international crimes.
And they go to jail where?
Usually in The Hague, I believe, but it can be in the prison of any member state of the ICC.
Who runs the ICC?
It runs itself, really. It is it's a freestanding organization that was established by a group, now 124 member states, and it has relationships with the United Nations and with the International Court of Justice, but it is an independent international agency.
So in this instance where you have Hamas's October attack and then the Israeli response, what kind of crimes would the International Criminal Court be looking at to charge both Hamas and Israeli officials with?
Basically crimes against civilians, against people who are not part of the ongoing conflict. The ICC has jurisdiction over four international crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. Any charges that are brought would be brought against individuals, not against the State of Israel or against the Hamas organization. The International Criminal Court has jurisdiction only over natural persons.
Bill Dunlap at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut. Protests at U.S. universities showed no sign of slowing over the weekend, with more arrests on campuses across the country and skirmishes between pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian demonstrators at the University of California, Los Angeles. As the size of the pro-Palestinian encampment at UCLA expanded in recent days, counter-protesters have become increasingly vocal and visible on campus, although both sides remained peaceful until Sunday. And that changed when some demonstrators broke through a barrier that the school had set up to separate the two factions. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday issued a fresh plea to the international community to hurry up and deliver more air defenses, invite Ukraine to join NATO, and start formal talks for his country to enter the European Union.
Ukraine has fulfilled all the necessary conditions for the actual start of accession negotiations, and now the European Union side must fulfill its obligations.
Ukrainian forces face a worsening position in the east and are still waiting for delivery of U.S. weapons following the April 23rd approval by Congress of a $61 billion aid package after months of delay. Zelensky has repeatedly pleaded for further air defense systems, particularly the Patriot system. We're following these other stories from around the world. Russian President Vladimir Putin likely didn't order the death of imprisoned opposition leader Alexei Navalny in February, according to U.S. intelligence officials. While U.S. officials believe Putin was ultimately responsible for the death of Navalny, the intelligence community has found that there's no smoking gun that Putin was aware of the timing of Navalny's death. Nigeria has secured a $600 million investment in seaport infrastructure from the Danish shipping company A.P. Moller Maersk. The announcement coming from the presidency in a post on X. Human rights groups and diplomats criticized a law that was quietly passed by the Iraqi parliament over the weekend that would impose heavy prison sentences on gay and transgender people. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said in a statement that the law passed Saturday threatens those most at risk in Iraqi society and can be used to hamper free speech and expression. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, America's high-tech industry is looking at the presumptive presidential candidates and their priorities concerning semiconductors. The Biden administration last week announced a major investment in the industry. Here's VOA's senior Washington correspondent, Carolyn Pursuti, with our story.
They're in our phones, our electric cars, our satellites, and even our refrigerators. Semiconductors, invented in the United States. But now, only about 12% of chips are made in America.
America manufacturing is back.
Through his Chips and Science Act, President Joe Biden campaigned this week with $6 billion in federal grants for Micron's new plants in New York and Idaho. Added to Micron's own $125 billion, Biden says it's the biggest private investment ever in the two states.
Folks, my predecessor and his MAGA Republican friends have a very different view. They oppose the Chips and Science Act that's powering this growth today. We got to stop this division. I promise to be president for all of America, whether you voted for me or not. Today's investment helps Americans everywhere.
During his presidential term, Donald Trump had Intel's then CEO announce the company's $7 billion chip project from the Oval Office.
Thank you, Mr. President, for this.
But there was no government money backing the project. Subsidizing semiconductor companies is a fairly new policy, and experts say it's where the two presidential candidates differ. James Lewis has been studying semiconductors and national security for 25 years.
You know, in 2015, if you'd asked most Americans, if you'd asked the Obama administration, do we need a chips policy, they would have said, no, everything's fine. What are you worried about? So this has only been recently, and the Trump administration changed our views towards China. This administration, though, has been the one that's been able to actually carry out some useful plans.
Trump, as president, handled China's threat in a different way. He used tariffs.
We've taxed China on $300 billion worth of goods and products being sold into our country, and China eats it.
$50 billion of that was on high-tech items. More recently on the campaign trail, candidate Trump on what he would do in a second term.
I will revoke China's most favored nation's trade status.
Since it was introduced, Biden's Chip and Science Act has triggered 83 projects to eventually increase the U.S. share of semiconductor manufacturing. Lewis says should Trump be reelected, he would need to implement a Chips and Science Act Part 2 to continue those efforts. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
At least 16 African countries, including South Africa, will hold elections in the remaining months of 2024. Voters who go online for political news are risking exposure to disinformation and misinformation. But a new digital ethics organization aims to help journalists and activists identify false and misleading content so they can educate the public. Sahir Kassim has the story from Johannesburg.
At first glance, the city of Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema announcing that he won't be running in the next election seems authentic, but it's fake. And these journalists in Johannesburg are learning how to spot the difference with the help from a non-profit called Campaign on Digital Ethics, or CODE. Kavisha Pillay is the founding director of CODE.
We're making sure that people are accessing information that is safe and is not going to be harmful, that the technology that we're using is not going to cause further harms to our society.
Working with CODE on this project is Africa Check, one of the continent's leading independent fact-checking organizations. The staff at Africa Check encourage people to send their suspicious content. They're collaborating with CODE to teach the public how to identify fake social media content. Keegan Leach is a researcher at Africa Check.
It helps to have not just someone to step in and do some work checking that kind of information, but also to be able to share tips and tricks and techniques for stepping in to stop that spread with anyone.
Community activist Manny Sigomani will be on high alert in the days leading to South Africa's May 29th elections, on the lookout for any fake content that might affect his ward.
I think we're moving into an era where more and more the truth is being distorted, and we kind of need these kind of initiatives to keep people grounded and to keep people responsible.
The Independent Electoral Commission of South Africa has announced it will work with Google, Meta and TikTok to help safeguard the integrity of the electoral process. Siri Kasim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Thousands of Socialist Party supporters marched in Madrid on Sunday, urging Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez to stay on. Sanchez said on Wednesday he would step back for a few days to decide whether he wants to continue leading the government after a court launched a business corruption probe into his wife's private dealings. Namibia is recognized as one of the few African nations to reach continental health targets outlined in the Abuja Declaration, allocating at least 15% of its national budget to health. Despite that progress, the country is struggling with its planned rollout of a vaccine, which was set to begin in April. Talio Angula has more.
Over the years, Namibia's government has dedicated a sizable portion of its budget to health and social services, with a proportion increasing over the years. This has not, however, always translated into improved health delivery, as seen in the delayed rollout of vaccinations for human papillomavirus, or HPV, which causes an estimated 90% of cervical cancers in women. Namibia's Minister of Health and Social Services, Kalumbi Shangula, told VOA Wednesday the country is on track with a mass immunization of adolescent girls and is simply figuring out the logistics. But he also highlighted Namibia's upper middle income classification by the World Economic Forum as a barrier to health funding in the country.
We are convinced that the basis for ranking is not sour, because we use the denominator, the population. Because you know the population in Namibia is small. The smaller the denominator, the higher the product. But we have many countries, maybe if those one with 50 million, are in a similar situation like Namibia, but they are at least developed country.
Namibia's cabinet last month charged Peya Mushalenga, Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, with lobbying other middle-income countries at forums such as the World Bank and United Nations to put direct pressure on Bretton Woods institutions to adopt the United Nations Development Programme Multidimensional Poverty Index as a more accurate determinant of a country's developmental status. The government believes the lower ranking is a more accurate indication of the country's development profile and will help it obtain loans and grants to aid its development programs.
Because of historical injustices of the colonial past, now the disadvantages, therefore, is that we are unable to access soft loans as I was saying.
Macroeconomic factors, such as the reported slowdown in production by one of the leaders in HPV vaccine production, Merck, could be a variable hurting Namibia's rollout of HPV vaccines, although VOA could not independently verify this. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
Success in the fight to wipe out polio is not guaranteed, according to tech billionaire turned philanthropist Bill Gates.
The world is very close to eradicating one of the most preventable threats humanity has ever faced. But it's not done until we get to zero. It can spread back to where it was before.
His foundation has poured billions into ending the disease. Gates welcomed a $500 million pledge from Saudi Arabia on Sunday to fight polio over the next 5 years.
The new commitment will deliver vaccines, measles immunizations, and other health services to 370 million children. It's an investment in the future of children around the globe and in strengthening health systems.
The $500 million from Saudi Arabia brings it in line with the United States as one of the biggest national donors. Tesla CEO Elon Musk arrived in Beijing on Sunday on an unannounced visit, where he's expected to meet senior officials to discuss the rollout of full self-driving software and permission to transfer data overseas, according to a person with knowledge of the matter. Here's Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder with more.
Full self-driving software, or FSD, is the most autonomous version of Tesla's autopilot software, launched 4 years ago. However, the U.S. electric vehicle maker has yet to make it available in China, its second largest market globally. Musk said this month Tesla may make FSD available to customers in China very soon. Industry experts say the complicated and busy traffic conditions in China provide more scenarios that are key for training autonomous driving algorithms at a faster pace. But Tesla is grappling with falling sales and an intensifying price war for EVs led by Chinese brands. There are also safety concerns. Tesla recalled more than 2 million vehicles in the United States in December to install new autopilot safeguards. U.S. auto safety regulators said on Friday they'd opened an investigation into whether that was adequate following a series of crashes. Tesla shares are down almost a third since the start of the year as concerns have grown about the EV maker's growth trajectory.
Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
1 year ago, two rival generals sent their armies into battle and set Sudan on a path of death, destruction, and devastation. Today, the fighting continues to rage, noted Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations.
We have all seen the reports of gang rape and mass murder at the hands of Rapid Support Forces militias, of women and girls being sold into sexual slavery, and boys forced to be child soldiers, of snipers indiscriminately targeting civilians, and militias slaughtering entire villages in Darfur. War has turned Sudan into a living hell. Nearly 25 million Sudanese people are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Three quarters of them face acute food insecurity.
Ambassador Wood called on both General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Lieutenant General Mohamed Hamdan, who leads the country's rapid support forces, to negotiate in good faith and cease further offensives.
Let's be clear. The two warring generals, who together led a military takeover in 2021, upending Sudan's democratic transition, are still standing in the way of a better future for the people of Sudan. Today I say to them, end this senseless war once and for all. Clearly, further pursuit of outright military victory only adds to an already staggering human cost.
The people of Sudan need more humanitarian assistance, and they need it now, stressed Ambassador Wood.
The people of Sudan are facing a crisis of epic proportions, with famine imminent. Yet, humanitarian organizations have not been allowed to deliver much-needed assistance. Unhindered humanitarian access must be allowed. Full stop. Humanitarian personnel must not be targeted or harassed as they try to meet critical needs of Sudanese civilians.
The United States is the largest donor of humanitarian aid to the region and has provided more than $1 billion since 2023, including the recent announcement of an additional $100 million to alleviate the humanitarian crisis in Sudan. Ultimately, Sudan's civilians should define Sudan's path going forward and restore the democratic transition they began and sacrificed for. The U.S. will continue to bring to the world's attention the plight of the Sudanese people and work to hold those responsible to account.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.